All right. So we're going to look at Esther 1 and 2, actually only through chapter 2, verse 18. So if you were trying to outline beyond 2:18, you're in big trouble because it goes with the next section. but let's just kind of remember to place Esther again in biblical history, because these books are not books that we know very much about or study very often. And when we do study them, it's interesting to me how people like to study Nehemiah, and Nehemiah comes up with all these kinds of principles for building walls and how that works in our life. It's just craziness. Anyway, I shouldn't have said that on the internet, I suppose, but there it is. So let's just think through the Bible again, the Old Testament particularly. And testament means what? Covenant. So it's an old covenant and a new covenant. And there is no split in the Bible. And what covenant is old? Mosaic covenant. So the new is contrasted with the Mosaic, and we are looking at the covenants as a growth. So you move from the Adamic covenant, which is not called a covenant when you read in the beginning of Genesis, but we know from Hosea chapter 6 that it is. And you move from the Adamic covenant to the Noahic covenant to the Abrahamic covenant to, some people say, well, the Davidic covenant, and then you move, I forgot, the Mosaic covenant after the Abrahamic covenant, and then the Davidic covenant, and then you move into the New Covenant, which starts in the Old Testament and comes to fruition in the New Testament. So we're in the New Covenant era of the Old Testament. Now, when we think just broadly about Genesis and then how the Bible works itself out, because God has a program and a plan and he's doing things in a certain way, we find that Esther fits into a particular type of the Old Testament history, which is important. So thinking back to Genesis 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way through chapter 8, we have this division of land. So in the Garden of Eden, we have the land, and we have the Garden of Eden, then we have the land of Eden, and then outside the land of Eden, we have the world. And the waters flow from this mountain down through the Garden of Eden, and they flow out to all the earth. And things changed, of course, after the flood. So Adam and Eve are in the Garden of Eden, where they meet with God and they sin against God. And so they are thrust out of the Garden of Eden into the land of Eden. And in the land of Eden, we have Cain and Abel. And Cain kills Abel. And so Cain is thrust out of the land of Eden into the world. And then in the world, we have Seth and his children, and we have Cain and his children, Seth being the replacement for Cain. And Seth and his children are the seed of God, the seed of the woman. And Cain and his children are the seed of the serpent. Going back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, where we have the proto-evangelical, which means what? First gospel is right. First good news, because they're in the midst of being cursed, and right in the midst of being cursed, God says that the seed of the serpent will bruise the heel of the seed of the woman, and the seed of the woman will bruise the head, which we would translate something like crush the head of the seed of the serpent. And that is why Jesus dies, not one reason, why Jesus dies hanging on a cross with his head over a hill that's called a skull, Golgotha, a skull. So he's dying and he's crushing the head of the serpent, in his death. Anyway, at any rate, so we have Seth, who is the seed of the woman, or the sons of God, and we have Cain and his seed, which are the seed of the serpent. And this carries down through our times. So everyone who is in Christ are the sons of God, the seed of the woman, and everyone who is outside of Christ are the offspring of Cain, so to speak, and they're the seed of the serpent. And this battle is being waged right now in the world, and that's the conflict that's going on. So what happened is Adam sinned against God. Cain sinned against his brother. So we have a sin against God. We have a sin against a brother. And Seth committed a marital sin. Seth and his seed, they saw that the daughters of men were beautiful. And so the two lines intermarried. So God had to destroy the earth. So you sin against God, you're cast out of the temple. You sin against your brother, you're cast out of the land. You sin, you commit this marital sin, and you're just destroyed. That's what happens in the early chapters of Genesis. Then that same theme works its way out in the rest of the Genesis, and then it works its way out in the Bible. So when we come to Abraham, Abraham's dealings are particularly with God. He builds altars, and he proclaims the name of the Lord at the altars. And then Jacob, he lives his life, and his life revolves around his struggle with Esau, not to mention his father as well. So we have the brother-brother relationship, and then the rest of Genesis is devoted to Joseph, and Joseph goes down into Egypt. He's not in the temple, so to speak. He's not in the land. He's outside in the world. So he's dealing with the world. And the issue is he going to be faithful to God? And right up first thing in Egypt, what happens when it comes to Joseph? Potiphar's wife said, "Hey, you look pretty good to me. Here, come sleep with me." So we come up with the marital issue. Is the Son of God going to give in to the daughters of men? And of course, you know what he did, and he's faithful. Then we see Bible history working out in three broad pictures after that in the Old Testament. We go through the Mosaic era, we go through the era of the kings, and then we go to the Restoration era. So in the Mosaic era, the issue that Israel is confronted with is idolatry, particularly sins against God. When we come to the king's era, right after David, Rehoboam comes to be king, and the nation is split. So we have this issue of brother-brother conflict through the era of the kings, and finally God casts them out of the land, and they go into captivity, which brings us down to where Esther is, and they return from captivity, but now they're in the world. And so the issue is, are they going to be faithful to God in the world? That's the issue that confronts the book of Esther. And initially, they are not faithful. Mordecai is not faithful to God, and he instructs Esther not to be faithful to God. And that's the way the book starts out. So that's just the broad picture. And so think of these three eras of Israel's history again. We have the Mosaic period where you have judges ruling, and it's a priestly system. And then we come to the kings and the kings rule. Of course, there's still a priestly system. But then when we come back from captivity, we don't have kings anymore. We have emperors. And so Israel is not watched over by kings, but God's work in Israel is watched over by emperors. And that's important when you come to think about the book of Esther. So let's turn to Isaiah chapter 44. Isaiah chapter 44. And I hope I'm right here. Jessica, would you read for us 21 to chapter 45, verse 3. Okay, so this is a prophecy of the return of Israel from captivity. They're going to come back, and they're going to come back under Cyrus, who's called a shepherd. And Cyrus says Jerusalem's going to be built, and Cyrus says the temple's going to be built. And then in chapter 45, verse 1, he's called the Anointed One, which means he's the Messiah. So again, if you think through Israel's history, God is working. And he's progressively revealing himself. So you think about the ways you've been taught, and if you've had some good teaching over your lifetime, you'll realize that when you study the book of Judges, you discover there, well, judges become types of Christ. Samson is a type of Christ. Or Moses. Moses is a type of Christ. It's stated right out in Deuteronomy chapter 18. He's a type of Christ. And then you move down through the period of the kings, and you know that David is a type of Christ, and Solomon is a type of Christ, and all the kings, in essence, are types of Christ. Insufficient, for sure. But now when you move into the Restoration era, now, instead of being Hebrew types of Christ, we're going to have Gentile types of Christ, and Cyrus is one of those types. He's my Messiah. He's the Anointed One. Now, we're going to discover, I mean, we know already he has a son named Cambyses, and then comes along Darius. And so these guys, too, as emperors, are picking up the being a type of Christ, and we're saying in Esther, even though we see the name Ahasuerus, we're talking about Darius, and he's a type of Christ. He's insufficient. But to understand Esther, we're going to have to understand that Darius, Ahasuerus, is a type of Christ. And that's what Isaiah is telling us. So we didn't read Isaiah chapter 43. If you read it, you'll see there in verse 3 of Isaiah 43 that God says, he's going to give Ethiopia, and he's going to give Cush and ransom for Israel. In other words, what God's going to do is he's going to take over the whole world and plant Jerusalem right there in the middle of the whole world, and that's where he's going to lodge with his people, and they become the center, but they're now, if you will, going back to the garden. We're not looking at the temple. We're not looking at the land of Eden. Now we're out in the world, and the center of the world is Jerusalem. And when you come down to the New Testament, that's just the case. The center of the world, even though Rome's the empire, the center of the world is Jerusalem. So we're dealing with Israel in the center of the world. Okay, so that's just the broad overview. Now let's refresh our memories about Ahasuerus. You remember that when you read Esther and you read Nehemiah and Ezra, and you look in your notes in your Bible, you will discover that most people have placed them under Xerxes and Artaxerxes down in 489 to 445 BC. And we are suggesting that Xerxes and Artaxerxes are like the title Pharaoh. They're not personal names. They mean king and great king. Pharaoh, you know, there are lots of pharaohs. They all had personal names, but they're called the pharaoh. So Xerxes and Artaxerxes are titles As Ahasuerus is a title, and Ahasuerus just means something that we know of today. It means the Shah. So it's not a personal name. So we're suggesting, for a lot of reasons, which we went over last time, I won't go over them all now, that Darius and Ahasuerus are the same person, and Darius Ahasuerus came to power in 522 B.C., 521 B.C., so that the events of Esther and the events of Ezra and Nehemiah take place in the reign of Darius. They're much earlier than we would think. Not in the 400s, but the 500s. It moves down to the 400s, but it doesn't start down around 465 like most people would see. And it makes a lot more sense, and it helps us understand the book of Esther better. Okay, so having just kind of rambled through that, any questions? Okay, so now we're going to pick up Esther, and we're going to look at chapter 1 and 2, and we're going to realize, okay, as we read this, this is not like reading Romans chapter 7 and our struggle against sin and all kinds of application. This is history. It's important, but you don't walk away with tons of application. You got to basically do the whole point to get to the main point of the book. So we'll work at it and we'll see what we come up with. Now, you can guess from your questions that chapters 1 through 218 are a chiasm. Right? And everybody knows what a chiasm is. In this case, it's going to have seven parts: A, B, C, D, C, B, A. And right at the center of is chapter 2, verse 1, where Ahasuerus remembers Vashti. And then there's going to be a second part to the book of Esther, and it's much longer, but it parallels the first part, and Ahasuerus is going to have a sleepless night, and he picks up the records, the remembrances. It's the same word. And you know, you can't see it in the English, but if you know Hebrew, then you see it. And he's going to read about what Mordecai did, and he's going to wonder, did we do anything for him? And that's the center of the second chiasm. And those two sections with those two centers are the key to the book, remembering Vashti and remembering Mordecai. And just to remind you then, that the word remember... Remember, Darius Ahasuerus is a type of Christ, and Christ is God, and you think through the Old Testament, and you pick up your Hebrew lexicon, and you look up the word remember, and lo and behold, you discover that many of the times it's about God remembering. God looks down, and he sees the suffering of the people in Egypt, his people, and he remembers his people. And where do we pick that up in the New Testament? The Lord's table. So when we sit down at the Lord's table, we're not there so much that we remember what Christ has done. Of course, we're doing that. But the word remember there is the word memorial. The Lord's table is so the Lord remembers us. We come eat with him, and he takes a look at who's around the table, and he says, "Oh, yeah, I remember that, Christy. She sure needs my help." That's on the internet now.
You didn't say Christy here.
Christy Gant, do you want her phone number? So that's how we're going to look at the book. So what we're going to do now in chapters 1 and 2 is we're just going to look our way through and answer some, you know, just some nagging questions, because we're not familiar with this kind of lifestyle so much. Most of us aren't dealing with the elite aristocratic circles, and so we don't understand so much what's going on here. Plus, the Persian culture is different than our culture. And so we'll just make our way through. So the first section, and I hinted at this, of course, in the notes, the first section is about a great feast. And chapter 2, verse 18 is about a feast for Esther. So we have our two bookends, feasts. Feast for Ahasuerus, And then Ahasuerus gets a new wife. And there's a feast. By the way, does God get a new wife? Yeah, he does. What's he do to the first wife? He divorces her. Oh, my goodness. Okay, we'll have to talk about that, won't we? All right, someone read for us verses 1 through 9 of Esther. Okay, so we think in our terms, we're used to the United States, except for the Hanging Chad incident. Remember that? Mm-hmm. We've had easy transitions in government. Most governments don't transition so easily. And so you think of Darius coming to the throne, and he comes to the throne, and he's trying to cement his rule over his 127 provinces. And so the accession banquet is going to take place when, you know, there's relative peace in the land. So that's probably why it takes place in the third year, not the first year. But in the third year, now he's cemented himself as king. Now, we see that in Israel's history too, don't we? Because when David became king, he reigned in Hebron for 7 years, and it took some time before all the tribes accepted David as king. Well, that's just what is happening with Darius, Ahasuerus. So in the third year of his reign, he has this six-month-long feast. So what he's doing is he's calling all the aristocratic people from all around his provinces, the government officials and the head of the army officials, and they're all coming together. And he's feasting with them for 6 months, 180 days, and then he lets them go because in Susa it gets really hot, hotter than Texas, in the summertime. So he feasts with them for the good period of time, and they're enjoying being rulers together. That's what's happening. We got power now. Then at the end of that, he holds a feast for all the people in Susa. And in Susa, it's the capital city, and he invites all the people to his feast, and it lasts for 7 days. Now, you can see that in this book, three's repeated a lot and seven's repeated a lot. And of course, it's not just by chance. It did happen this way, but God is the one who conducts history. He's sovereign over history. And in biblical numerology, three is important, seven's important. And if we just think with Christ, three, the third day, big changes take place, because when Christ rose from the dead, the old creation is left behind, and the new creation has started, Christ being the firstborn from the dead. And ever since then, people are being called the Christ, and they're born from the dead spiritually, and they will be resurrected from the dead physically. This new creation has started all the way back in 30 AD. The old creation begins to be set behind, and by 70 AD, it is set behind, and the new creation starts. Well, that's what's happening here. The old regime is done, the new regime has begun, and something significant is going to transpire under Darius's regime, his power. And that is, Israel's going to be cemented, and they're going to destroy their enemies, and multitudes of people are going to join themselves to the God of Israel. That's what's going to happen in the book of Esther. It's prophesied in Ezekiel 38 and 39. It's also prophesied in Zechariah chapter 2, verses 9 through 11. We won't take time to look at that. So they have this big feast, and then he calls in these the citizens of Susa. And we're told that the feast then is a drinking feast. Verse 7. Now, what's important about that? I mean, why are we told that? Is it because, you know, we're being told about the ills of drink? Wine is for kings in the Bible. Is correct. And so, when we think about God's history then, in the Old Testament, at the tabernacle, in the temple, in the rebuilt temple, we have no wine in the temple for drinking. It's poured out at the base of the altar, a libation offering. But when God's people move from being priests to being priests and kings, when does that take place? The church. Then when God's people meet in the temple, we are the temple, you don't pour out the drink offering anymore. You drink the drink offering. And it's not grape juice. It's wine. Okay? But they're drinking according to the customs and the laws, and everybody gets to drink as they desire. That shows us something about King Darius. Because the custom, what do you think the custom is? I mean, when the king pulls up his glass and he gives a toast and he throws it back, what are you supposed to do? Same thing. So what do you suppose happens at this kind of feast? Lots of drunks. A big mess. But Darius is a different kind of man. No, everybody can drink as they desire. Now, of course, he's...
I thought it was contrasted with Daniel as well. They were...
No, we're not to that section yet. It's coming, but it's not here. So, here we're getting a glimpse of who Darius is. Now, he's not perfect, and we're going to see in chapter 2, he's really far from perfect. But when we think about other types of Christ, such as David, he was far from perfect. And Solomon, even though David's called a man after God's own heart, far from perfect. And Solomon, far from perfect, yet they are types of Christ. But we're getting a glimpse that Darius is a different kind of emperor than people have been used to. Now, in verse 6, we're told about the lavish place where this is taking place. Why are we told that? Just because it happened that way? Pardon me?
A king has a palace.
And so it reminds us, because God is going to take Cyrus by his right hand, which means he's going to take Darius by his right hand in succession, because when you set up the succession of David, Solomon, and so forth, they're all sons of God. They're all adopted as God's sons. Now God's doing the same thing with the emperors. And he's taking them by the right hand. And whatever is done for God, God's the one doing it. But if you that means that Darius is next to God. And it reminds us that when God's temple was built, and the word for temple is the word palace, at the same time, Solomon's palace was built. And they were right next door to each other. And so Solomon sits on God's right hand. He's the right-hand man to God at his temple. Solomon is in his temple. Now that picture is being conveyed to us in terms of the person of Darius. So we're described this picture that has hangings and lavish colors just like the tabernacle had in it to give this kind of indication. Well, here's a king, and God is going to use him, and we also know it because we just read Isaiah, and so we're quite savvy. Then verse 9 sets us up for what's going to happen, because at the same time that Ahasuerus is throwing his party for the men of Susa, Vashti is throwing her party for the women of Susa. Any question? That's our first section, a great accession feast. So, you know, when Obama gets elected and they have all the balls that the president goes to, he goes with his wife too. It's not just him. You know, back in these days, they separated men and women a little more, but she's the queen. So the feast that she gives is to, of course, enjoy the fact that, hey, she's queen now. She belongs to Darius, and he's just... All women have power. What are you talking about?
He decides to do that. As the wise man. And has no choice.
All right, let's just think about her power here, all right? So who would like to read for us verses 10 through 12? Okay, so when we think through, mostly this is talked about in the Old Testament, so we'll think through the Old Testament. When we think about women, does the Old Testament speak kindly to the beauty and shapeliness of women? Yeah, it does. So you know, you look at Song of Solomon 2, and, you know, the king says, right there in the Bible pages, your form is lovely. And we think about Genesis and Rebecca and Rachel. We're told they're beautiful women. So God makes women beautiful. And men like to marry beautiful women. And the more beautiful the woman, says what about the man? Well, if the man is just downright ugly and the woman's real beautiful, everybody's thinking... I have to ask, is Brad ugly or So we have this we maybe don't like to admit it. I don't know exactly how our culture thinks now, but men like people to know the kind of wife they got. Unless they're not happy with her, of course. And, you know, different men in the church have told me things about, well, I like my wife to look like this and wear such and such. And why is he telling me that? Because he wants people to know, hey, look what I got. This is my wife. And it's probably a bit of self-love because he's saying something about himself. Look what kind of guy I am. I got this woman. Well, I'm assuming that Ahasuerus is typical, and he is, of course, in world history at this time, the preeminent man. And so, of course, he's going to have a beautiful wife. He's got the pick, and he's got Vashti. And so he, in his accession feast, wants to show off his power, his worth. And I don't want to formulate it as all bad because God made women to be beautiful. And so he wants her to come in with her royal crown. Now from this, some people have decided that the reason Vashti wouldn't come is because he wanted to come crowned with nothing on. But the text doesn't say that. That's just the imaginations of... Who knows who? Whoever said it. So she just doesn't want to come. Coming with a royal crown would suggest, you know, look at my queen. And she does have some power. Exactly what that is, I don't know. I don't know what Michelle Obama's powers are. Probably more than we want to know. And she refuses to come. And so he becomes very angry. Now, should she have come? Yes. Let's turn to Psalm 45. Psalm 45. And someone read for Psalm 45 is a marriage psalm of the king to his bride. Of course, it's in Israel's history, and it is messianic. So in one sense, it talks about Christ and the church. Someone read for us verses 10 and 11. Okay, so here we have a biblical statement about a king who's getting married, and what the wife is supposed to do is to forget her father's house. Now, of course, that doesn't mean she forgets her father and her mother and doesn't ever think of them again. It means that she has moved from one head to another head, and she has to follow and obey and submit her new head, not her old head, her dad. And she's a beautiful woman, so the king's going to desire her, and together they're going to produce children. That's the way God set things up. So the same thing is true of the church. When we individually are taken out of the world and we're put into the church, that's what we're asked to do. We're going to talk about it Sunday. We're asked to take up a cross and deny self. In other words, we're going to leave the old behind, and we're going to submit and obey to our new head who's going to lead us and direct us. We're going to follow what he says. Well, this is what Vashti was supposed to do, and Vashti was unwilling to do it. I guess nothing else needs to be said there, right? No, I don't know what it means. I didn't look it up. Sorry. But I will find out for you by next time. Yeah, but now you got me interested. There you go. That fits. And what does Esther mean? I know that one, star. What's her Hebrew name mean? Myrtle tree. And the tree of the Restoration era is the myrtle tree. The tree of the kingly era is what? The cypress. No, the cedar, I'm sorry. It's the cedar. And the tree of the Abrahamic era? The tree, actually it's, what's it called? I can't remember. Anyway, there are different trees that go with different eras of Bible history. All right, let's have someone read then verses 13 to the end of the chapter. That was the B section. Yeah. We're going to move from submission, the rebellion of Vashti to its counterpart, B section, the submission of Esther. Okay, someone read for us verses 13 to the end of the chapter. Grace, you want to read that? So we're going to see through the book of Esther that Ahasuerus is a wise king in this sense. He doesn't make unilateral decisions. He does seek counsel, and in this case, he seeks the counsel of his seven advisors, and their concern has to do with Persian law. So I'm assuming that Persian law has some statements like biblical law has about the relationship between men and women, and Vashti has violated that. And now their concern is, if you take the highest person in the land and she treats her husband this way, she has set a precedent that other women will follow. So their counsel is she can't come to the king anymore. In other words, she's going to be divorced from the king. And so the king follows the advice, and he issues the decree, and he sends it out to all of the provinces in their own language, and he gives us the sense of it, that every man should be the master in his own house, and the one who speaks in the language of his own people. Now, what does that mean? Well, the first part's simple. It just means the man's the head of the house. And if the head of the house says, you know, I'm having a big feast and I want you to come in and stand beside me so I can present you as my queen, you come. That's simple enough. And that's biblical enough. We know that whether we like it or not, this is the way God set things up, because marriage is meant to be a picture of Christ and the church. And of course, when Christ says, do this, it's not supposed to be optional. We treat it as optional. And that's why the Father has to discipline us then, because we do treat what Christ says is optional, but we're his bride. And when he says, do this, we're supposed to submit. So that's clear enough. Not so hard to understand. But what does it mean that every man is supposed to speak the language of his own people? Yeah, maybe. This is one of these mental stumpers in commentaries. Nobody knows quite for sure. But here's a guess. Let's just turn back to Numbers 13. Let's read verses. Grace, you read it because it's got names in it again, I think. 23 through 27, and you can stumble that way.
Oh.
Yeah. 23 through 27. Not Numbers, I'm sorry, Nehemiah. There you go. I said turn back a page and then, where's that? Yeah. 23 through 27. 13, last chapter. Okay, so what this section does is it gives us maybe a clue. So you have all kinds of movements of peoples because, you think through this period of history and the Assyrians have carted off with different nations, and then the Babylonians cart off with different nations, and then Cyrus comes along and he's letting people go home. But when you have a mixture of nations, what do you end up having? You have mixed marriages. And in mixed marriages, you come with mixed languages. That's not a crime. It's not a sin. It was a sin for Israel to have that kind of mixed marriage when they weren't supposed to marry women of certain foreign nations because, as it says here in Numbers, what's going to happen is what happened to Solomon. That is, you're going to marry a wife who is so pretty and so nice, and she carries all that power. You're going to desire her, and she's going to want this God, not your God. So that's why he beats them and pulls out their hair. Sounds a little vicious, doesn't it? He'd be taken to, he'd need some sensitivity counseling. Because after all, the body is everything, and you can't have a mark on it or anything like that. That's on the internet. Okay, if we pick up that idea and every man is to speak the language of his people, it seems like what Ahasuerus is saying, okay, we have a lot of mixed marriages, and we want the man to be in charge. So his language is going to be the language of the house. That may be what he's saying. If the woman speaks the language and the man doesn't know it very well, then she gains the upper hand in the house. So that might be what he's saying. At any rate, so what by law and by counsel, what exactly the laws are, we don't know for sure, but by law and by counsel, Vashti is deposed, probably divorced, and a decree is sent out to all the land so that each man will be the master in his own house so that we won't have women taking over things. Now, does that kind of thing really happen? Was that a proper concern? Exactly. The answer is yes, because we see it happening in our land. If you're old enough, you've seen a huge transition from the 60s to today. And how does it take place? It's because the people on the bottom are looking to the people on the top. And what the people on the top do, that's what they want to do. They become like them. So there's been a whole cultural revolution. So, you know, we have Obama who comes in to office and he says he's against gay marriage. In the middle of the office, because his two girls don't see anything wrong with it, at least this is what he told us, then he's for gay marriage. And what do you see happening in the country? The percentage of those who are in favor of gay marriage goes up and up because people really do look to their leaders. And so when leaders do wrong, it causes lots of wrong problems in a culture. And so he's right to be concerned. Whether they dealt with it the right way or not is really not the issue here. This is what takes place, and it's setting up the fact that Esther is going to become queen. Okay, so now we come to chapter 2, and verse 1 is the middle where he remembers Vashti. And verses 2 through 4 parallel this council section that we just looked at the end of chapter 1. Now there's going to be council again. So someone read first 1 through 4 of chapter 2. Okay, so King Ahasuerus, his anger finally subsides, and it seems like his anger burned for a long time, about 3 years. And it finally subsides, and he remembers Vashti and what she did and the fact that she's deposed, and he needs a queen. That's what the whole remembering is for. Now, whether he needs a wife or not, we're not told. So I'm not assuming that this king is a celibate king during all of this anger. And we wouldn't assume it because of the way he gets a new wife. Right? But what he's remembering is, hey, I don't have a beautiful woman to stand at my side so that I can say, well, here's the queen of the land. I need a queen. So what is it? Is it the French or is it the Italian? I don't remember which, where the president had a lover. That didn't work in those days. You had to have a wife to be your queen.
One lover, one mistress, another one, and the state dinners didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, 2 through 4 parallels the last section of chapter 1 because he's getting counsel again. So in 1:13 to the end of the chapter, we're dealing with counsel with King Ahasuerus. Now in 2 through 4, we're dealing with counsel to King Ahasuerus, and verse 1 is the center of the chiasm. And now we're going to move to the section that picks up Vashti's rebellion. Now we're going to look at Esther's submission. So they're suggesting that all these beautiful girls be gathered, and presumably that's not by force. I suppose it could be. Not by force, but they go throughout the land. And remember, this is a huge land. This is going to take some time. And it would seem like then, based on what we know from the book of Esther, that Mordecai says, you know, it would be good for us, Esther, if you were the queen. It'd be good for Jewish people if you were the queen. And you're a beautiful girl, so how about if we try this out? Well, of course, we can't commend that, can we? So you have these girls who are going to be picked, and then they're going to be given a year to beautify themselves for the king. And then at one night, they're going to get called in to sleep with the king. And if the king's happy, he might have another night. Or he might say, well, let me test out the others, see which one I really want. Well, we can't commend that. And people say, well, how can this guy be a type of Christ then? Well, we just have to go back to David. How many wives did David have? How many wives did Solomon have? Yeah, and 300 concubines. What's the difference between a concubine and a wife? Don't answer, Grace. Anybody know? Well, only in a certain sense. So when we think of a dowry in the Old Testament, a dowry is money that's given to a woman so that she can take care of herself if her husband gets rid of her or dies. A concubine doesn't get that dowry. She's still a wife. She just didn't get a dowry. That's the difference. Okay, so now we come to the very interesting section in verses 5 through 17. Who would like to read that? Okay, Jessica, that's good. Okay, so we have this process of gathering all the beautiful virgins of the land. I assume those who are willing. Maybe some aren't willing. But probably they're agreeing to this. And they come and they go through their 1 year of treatment, 6 months, oils for the skin to soften them up, and 6 months spices to make them smell good. And given all the food of the land, I'm sure the rich kind of foods, the good kind of foods, and Esther becomes a part of this. And then what you're trying to do is you're trying to make yourself desirable to the king so that you can become queen. What separates Esther from the others is instead of she thinking she knows what to do, she lets the eunuch tell her what she should do. So she shows that she's of a, and maybe this is subtle and maybe it's really not the point, but she shows that she's of a different character than Vashti, who stood opposed to her husband, whereas Esther, well, she submits wrongly to Mordecai, because he says to her, don't tell people who you are. Is that wrong? Should she have submitted to that? Yeah, that's a true statement. He was her head. But there are certain things that God has told us to do. For example, let's say we have a couple and the man doesn't go to church and the woman wants to go to church and she's a believer and the man says, no, you can't go. Should she submit? No, she should not submit. Why? Yeah, God first. So Israel is being thrown among the nations to give a name for God. So if someone says, well, don't tell who you are, don't tell you're a Jew, God's people, then you should not submit. She did submit. So she has a submissive kind of character, and she submits to what the eunuch tells her will win her favor. And she goes into the king, and she wins the favor, and the crown is set upon her head. She is not like Daniel. This is what Grace is bringing up. When Daniel was brought all the king's food, he refused the king's food, although it does seem like later on maybe accepted it. But in this case, Esther does not refuse the king's food. She does whatever they say. And I think all that just to show a bit about what her nature is, her willingness to submit. She's different than Vashti. There are a couple of points in here, though, that we need to consider, and we talked about one of them last week. We're given the genealogy of Mordecai, and the way Hebrew genealogies work, we don't know if Kish and so forth refer all the way back to the father of Saul, or if this is actually Mordecai's grandfather or great-grandfather, because in genealogies, you can skip generations. But what it is showing us is that there's a connection between Mordecai and Kish, who is the father of Saul, so we have a link with Saul. And Saul lost his power. He was taken out as king for what reason? He did not kill the Amalekites. He kept Agag alive and a lot of the sheep. Oh, well, these are to offer to the Lord. Obedience is better than sacrifice. Well, now we're going to deal with the Amalekites in the book of Esther again. So the battle is on. And the Amalekites are who? Who are they? And they're Haman. Edomites. They're Esau. So we have a conflict between Jacob and Esau taking place in the book of Esther, as well as an involvement in the world. So the battle is going to be on between the Amalekites and between returned Israel from captivity. So we're given that little statement about Mordecai. And Mordecai's name means what? Your Bible tell, Kristen.
Name derived from Marduk?
Exactly. A worshiper of Marduk, which is a god of Persia. So Mordecai is not cast in a good light initially. He is willing to send his cousin into a harem. He tells her, don't give your identity. No. It is not. And why isn't it? There's no threat. There's no threat here. There's no, Mordecai is the one who's going to create the threat. There is no threat at this point. So remember, Cyrus and Darius are favorable to the Jews. Oh, yes, go build the temple. They're favorable. So to hide your identity, I'm not quite sure. Maybe as we go through the book, we'll discern it. But to hide your identity, this is not a good deception. This is just a flat-out lie. So it's not good.
That Mordecai's problem wasn't turning to Jerusalem. Now that kind of
is not a wrong behavior.
It's okay to be out. Not okay to be out, but it's okay to be out.
Yeah, exactly how he is in Susa, we don't know. He's listed actually under the returnees, but he's not in Jerusalem. He's in Susa. So it could be that he has been drawn here for government purposes. We're going to see in chapter 3 that he is a government official. Whether he gets that only because Esther becomes queen or not, we're not exactly told, but he... One of the reasons for dating Esther in this time period is Mordecai did return. People will argue it's not the same Mordecai, but I don't see any reason why not to, you know, there's, why would we posit two Mordecais? But anyway, if we put the book way down later, then Mordecai would be something like 130 years old. So it has to be here. So Mordecai's, because his Hebrew name is not mentioned, Marduk, because he hides his identity as a Jew, and because he's willing to throw his cousin into a harem, we're not talking about a great Jewish fellow here, are we? And so we'll have to figure out why is that going on. But at any rate, the section here then shows us all sin involved, God's got his hand into it. And God brings Esther to the throne, and she becomes queen. And, you know, if you just think in man's terms, how likely is that? Well, it's not very likely. But God makes it happen. Because if you, I don't know how many virgins were there. We weren't told. Let's suppose there's 100 beautiful virgins. Well, how do you know you're going to be the one virgin that attracts the king? Well, because that's where God wants Esther. And so even though God's name's not mentioned in the book, we see God at work behind the scenes in the book, and it will really become evident by the end of the book. And my wife poked me that it's time to go because I have to go to a meeting. Okay, someone read for me verse 18. Wouldn't that be something if at accession time, when the president comes to power, he rolls back your taxes and gives you some gifts. Because this is what happened when Vashti became queen. He gave back some of their money and he gave them presents. He's happy with he's happy with Esther. So if you just look then at the section, we're looking from the outside, moving our way in. We have the two banquets, the two feasts, the accession of Ahasuerus, and then at the end, the accession of Esther. And then you move in two notches to B and B prime, and you have Vashti's rebellion, and you have the submissiveness of Esther, and then you move in from there to C and C prime, and you have the two council sessions where Ahasuerus is getting counsel that he follows from his advisors, and then right at the center, Ahasuerus remembers Vashti and what she did. In other words, I need a new queen. And then we'll pick it up next week. We obviously won't do the whole section. We'll do a couple of chapters, though, two or three. We won't. And so I'll try and get the questions out by Monday morning. That make people happier? Then you can be befuddled for more days than one.